Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi there, welcome to another Rahulastapa, this one recorded just last Sunday in Sheffield with Ian McMillan. You're one lucky people you are, it's a bonus for you. We're still on tour, we've got one more in 2019, which is today, if you're listening to it on the day of broadcast, Friday the 6th of December in Hull. Plenty of tickets left, Lucy Beaumont and Graham Fellows, who's the man behind John Shuttleworth and Jilted John and much, much more. We're also on the road next year. We're doing Leicester Square Theatre in March and April. We're also doing the Birmingham Podcast Festival on March the 28th, I believe. That one sold out last year very quickly, and it's selling incredibly well already. It's only £12 a ticket, and it's just one guest, but I'm aiming for a biggie. We're also in Norwich, which is also two shows, both selling very quickly. So be quick if you want to get tickets to those. Go to richardherring.com/gigs, richardherring.com/rahulastapa/tour. You can see all the places we're coming on tour. And also go to gofasterstripe.com. You can buy emergency questions books. You can buy Rahulastapa top trumps very soon, if not right now. Perfect Christmas gifts, lots of DVDs and downloads as well. If you fancy getting something for your friends, or if you want to suggest to your friends and family what you would like, because they're not cool enough to know about Rahulastapa, why not tell them about this? You can buy all three different emergency questions books for £20 if you're quick. There's a book bundle there, which is incredible value. That's three Christmas presents, three Secret Santas, and you can keep a tenner and stick it in your pocket and run home. So anyway, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahulastapa.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Sheffield City Hall. Please welcome a man who is hoping he will not be heckled by any hardcore knitters today. It's Richard Herring! It's miles. It's miles across the stage. Hello, Sheffield. Oh, my goodness. How lovely to be here. Thank you so much for coming. You're wonderful. My tour manager, James, I think wants to give you a round of applause just to test the mic. So give me another round of applause now. Yeah. Totally bogus. Just did that for the feeling. It's lovely to be here. First time ever in the main room. I played the small room, but this is the first time. People all the way right. Don't bother looking. Right to the top. Right up there, mate. Yeah. You don't know. So it's fantastic. It's fantastic to get this and be here. And welcome to Richard Herring's launching Sheffield Thursday podcast. Got to come up with a new podcast. I've decided to get a new football team in Sheffield. There hasn't been a new one for a while. Try and piss off. Just basically for that gag, just so... It's an unusual name, isn't it? Because you know that it came out of the Wednesday Cricket Club, didn't it? That was how it started, and then they did a football version, and then it became Sheffield Wednesday. It's perfectly understandable. But I was hanging out at the Crucible today, playing snooker against myself. And me on a full-size board as well. It's terrible. And me one says he calls it Rahelastaba. So I know that's some cool kids in from Sheffield. Good to see you. The last time I was here, or one of the recent times I was here, I was heckled by... One of my favourite heckles was from a hardcore knitter in the audience. So I'm hoping they're in today. They might start heckling again. That was what the intro was about. And it is lovely to be here in Sheffield. Of course, Sheffield, named after the River Sheath, because the River Sheath's called that because, of course, it is full of sheaths every weekend. That's my joke about Sheffield. Let's see if I've got anyone's. Oh, yes, Robin Hood is, of course, from Sheffield, isn't he? That's the Nottingham claiming, but... That is not correct. Robin of Loxley, the non-existent fictional character Robin Hood, is actually from Sheffield, and it's very important. And if you would open a Tales of Robin Hood in Sheffield, because Nottingham closed there, and it was the best thing there has ever been. So come on, reclaim that thing that didn't exist as yours. What's wrong with you people? There are 4 trees per person in Sheffield. Did you know that? 4 trees for every person. Seems a dangerous thing to do in a city that's trying to sell knives and forks to give everyone access to chopsticks. That is foolish. Of course, as we know, the Sheffield industry is not what it was, and nowadays 90% of men in Sheffield just make their living by stripping, however unpleasant looking they are, taking their clothes off for loose change. What else have I got? Oh, it's of course Sheffield invented. They're obsessed with steel here. They've invented so many things to do with steel. They love steel in Sheffield. They invented stainless steel. And you like steel too much if you're trying to invent a wipe clean version of it. That's too far. You've gone too far. I can't read my own writing now in this bit. Oh, no, that's all right. I've done that joke already. Okay, good. Well, look, we're going to... Going to more or less crack straight on. I will say that this is nearly the last podcast of 2019. We're doing one in Hull next Friday. If you have any friends up there, do let them know. A lot of people doing that 2010 to 2020 thing. In 2010, I had a Hitler moustache. That's how I began 2010. In 2020, as I end, I'm clearing stones and have 2 kids. I don't know if that's... I don't know if my decade's gone well or badly. I can't really play myself at snooker on Wednesday in front of an audience of 55 people. Can't work out if that's good or bad. Right, look, we're going to crack straight on. My guest this week, just there's only one, we do one show a week, remember. He's probably best known from his appearances on Nevermind the Full Stops. He was on twice, which is impressive. He was also, of course, the drummer in Oscar the Frog. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome Ian McMillan? It's a long way away. There he is. Oh, he's dashing across. There he is. Here's a microphone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Love to see you. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is to this cavern, the cavernous halls of Sheffield City Hall. How are you doing?
Very well, I've had a great day. My Yorkshire puddings rose like chef's hats. They've been really bad. For about 3 months, they've been like little beer mats. But today, they rose wonderfully. I did the same thing. The mixture was the same. The oven was the same temperature. The lard was the same. Nothing was different, but they rose. So I sent a photograph of them to my son-in-law, who always pretends that his Yorkshire puddings are better than mine. And my grandson calls them Yorkshire puddings, which gives them a certain dignity. So they were fantastic. So it's been a great day today so far.
Good. And well done for staying on brand as a professional Yorkshireman. Of course. Straight from the bat. Straight off the bat.
I'm actually from Surrey and living there all the time. But
it would be offensive. It could be offensive in someone else's hands. What are you doing?
Are you thinking of Dickie Bird?
I could be. Do you remember being on... I was on Never Mind the Full Stops. I don't think we were on the same show.
Never Mind the Full Stops was that fantastic grammar quiz.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? Presented by the chap who wrote Downton Abbey.
Yeah, Julian Fellowes. I found it quite annoying, I have to say.
All I remember was that they kept asking you grammar questions that you didn't know the answer to. So you thought, if I pretend to scratch my leg, that'll be a sign to them that I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And it didn't work at all. So they ask you a question, you go, well, I'll tell you something. And you're scratching your leg. And then after a bit, they said, Ian, just stop scratching your leg for a minute. And I said, well, I don't know the answer to any of these grammar-based questions.
Yeah.
It was a straight... I was on with Jenny Murray.
Well, there you go.
Also from Barnsley. There she is. She comes to all my shows, me and Jenny, Dickie Bird over there. They're all here.
I thought it was too hard. When you do the retakes at the end... June and Fellows was going, oh, no, Richard, I'm afraid you've got that wrong. There's the apostrophe goes here. And I went, oh, fuck off.
Still, I see the Apostrophe Society today have actually packed up.
Right.
They've decided there's no point in carrying on with that lie that you need apostrophes in the right place. Of course, it's a fib. It's a total fib. People say it's a rule. It's not a rule. It's a convention. Okay. I love it when people put them in the so-called wrong place. When people go, I'm cleverer than that greengrocer because I know where the apostrophe goes in tomatoes. And you think, well, get a life. Just get a life. It don't matter.
See, that's what I felt. I felt when I saw you being on Never Mind the Full Stops, I didn't feel you were the natural contestant in that because I don't think you would be that bothered about the conventions.
No, I'm not bothered about them at all. I think people can spell words how they want. They can put apostrophes where they want. They can put full stops where they want. It makes it more exciting, particularly if you're trying to cross the road.
And
I just thought of that gag. You know, I might keep that forever.
Keep it. Tell me about Oscar the Frog being the drummer in Oscar the Frog, one of your first...
Yes, Oscar the Frog. I think when you're 15, you want to be in a band.
Yeah.
And so me and my mate said, let's form a band. And we were going to call it Salt in Bulk because a van drove past my mate's house and said, Salt in Bulk. And we thought, no, maybe not Salt in Bulk. And then, of course... We thought of Oscar the Frog. Then somebody pointed out years later that, in fact, Monty Python had something called Ethel the Frog. And there was a band called Ethel the Frog from Hull. But anyway, we formed Oscar the Frog. And I said, I want to be the drummer. But we had no drums. So I had to use Tupperware. My mum's Tupperware. Big ones for salad, obviously. And I had no drumsticks. So I had to use knitting needles. And so I was playing the Tupperware and the knitting needles. And my mate played the bass, and we got a gig at the Darfield Church Hall garden party, not garden party, jumble sale. A room about this big, a stage this big. And Roland McArdle said, look, what we'll do is we'll let them start buying, then we'll open the curtains, and you'll give them 20 minutes, then we'll shut the curtains. And it was fantastic, because you could hear him buying all these goods. Then Roland McArdle went, right, you're on, and he wound the thing like that, and the curtains opened, and we played 20 minutes. Songs like, we used to sing Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree backwards, because they thought it was really funny, and it's not funny at all. And with the ribbon yellow, I tie tree oak all the round, years long three bean, it's me, what still you do? And it was... And we did 20 minutes of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Then the curtain shut, and nobody took any notice. They were just carried on buying stuff. But then you're bit by the showbiz bug, so you think, right, I'm going to go. And so we became Barnsley's first folk rock band, and we're playing all over the place. And then eventually, I bought some drums, and I was so bad that they sacked me and my mate, the bass player, without telling us. So somebody rang up and said, I saw your band last week, you weren't in it. So I rang up and I said, what happened? They said, we thought he'd lost interest. I said, I haven't lost interest. They said, well, actually, it's because you're crap. I said, well, I know. But then, so just me and my mate then, with either drums, he had the bass. And of course, it's too early for drum and bass, so we didn't know what to do. So we then formed a comedy duo called Jaws that went round folk clubs singing the aforementioned Tyler Ribbon. And also, we used to do this thing where I used to sing Chattanooga Choo Choo whilst eating two bags of crisps without swallowing any. And we thought that was so funny. And the front row would get sprayed in crisps. And at folk clubs, it was great because you'd do that. And then the organiser would get up and say, good old lads. You say, good old lads. And then and somebody else would come on. And we did things like, we said, halfway through, we got our mate, Cess Cartledge, to turn up carrying... I wish I was making some of this up. Carrying an accordion. And he'd come in to wherever the gig was, halfway through, and go, sorry I'm late, lads. I missed me tram. And, of course, there were no trams. And we thought that was even funnier than singing... And imagine the silences that we sat through. It was great. But then, of course, you know, the showbiz bug is bit. Are you bit by the showbiz bug? Oh, Oscar the Frog. We made a single that was really terrible, and we had a load pressed, but then we were so embarrassed by it that we threw it away in a kind of another Dadaist event. We threw it into River Dern, like chucking the Yorkshire puddings that I mentioned before that weren't as good.
So they're in there somewhere. This is like that.
Well, they just have made their way down to Hull.
Yeah.
They're just coming out by Barrow and Humber.
Well, those could be worth a lot of money. There's an E.T. game, isn't there? There was a video game of E.T. that got buried in a desert, and it was terrible, but it's worth loads of money.
Could be that, then. Or the people of Barrow and Humber could be sitting on a fortune if they dig one up.
Look out for that. So let's talk about... I mean, you've lived in the same town, Darfield.
Yes.
Whole life?
Yes, all my life. I was born there in 1956. My dad was away at sea, so I was born in my auntie's house on 34 North Street. And for years, my mother never told me the facts of life. I said, Mother, how was I born? She went, you weren't born, you were brought through the snow by a nurse. Which is a beautifully poetic thing. I was about 35. And she, that's not true. But the thing was, my dad was in the Navy. Him and my mum met as pen pals in the war. My mum was from Barnsley, my dad was from Scotland. They met as pen pals. This most romantic thing, where single service people could write to each other. And they wrote to each other for 2 years before they met. They tried to meet for afternoon tea in Queen's Hotel in Leeds, but because it was the war, they just missed each other. My dad was sailing around the world. My mum was stationed in Lancashire. And eventually, they got married on a 48-hour pass. And my dad sent this telegram to my mum that said, get leave now. And my mum sent a telegram back saying, cannot get leave. And he sent another telegram, get leave now. Meanwhile, he's coming up to Peebles, where they're going to get married. My mum... They wouldn't let her go, so she climbed over the fence. And I said, how did you manage to climb over the fence? And she said, Elsie distracted the sergeant. And I never quite knew what that was. And then my dad stood at the top of the church steps with a bolt of Chinese silk under his arm that his sister was going to make into a wedding dress. Didn't have time. They got together. My mum ran. He got off the wrong station at Peebles, ran up the main street of Peebles, her hat fell off, her waff hat. They got married. They had one night of passion together at Tontine Hotel in Peebles. Then my dad disappeared on secret war work and then came back. And then my mum went back to the WAFs and got arrested 2 weeks in prison for love. And that was always their story. They'd tell it every day. They'd tell it every night. Eventually, I worked out they're making quite a bit of it up. And in fact, my dad didn't have a bolt of Chinese silk under his arm. Maybe that's why he ended up telling stories, because they were just great at telling tales. Yes, I've always lived in the same place.
Yeah.
Which is great. It just means that everybody... Everybody knows you. You know, so I go into the shop and they go, hey, up, watch out. He'll write a poem about this. Shut up, say out. You go to the shop and you go, bag of plain crisps. They go, hey, put that in a poem, put that in a poem. I was walking down the street in Darfield and somebody was walking across this zebra crossing and they almost got knocked over by a scooter. And she put that in a poem, put that in a poem. And I got this fantastic heckle in Darfield. When I was walking through the middle of Darfield and this car pulled up, and this bloke wound the window down and went, Ian Macmillan? I went, yes. He said, you're on the radio? I said, yeah. He said, you're on the telly? I said, yes. He said, you write poems? I said, yeah, I do. He said, you're shite. He drove off like that. And I thought, God bless the working class. Can't live with them. Can't live without them.
At least he's seen the whole thing.
And he's seen the whole thing.
I've given you a chance. I've seen every single thing you do.
Yeah, he was a completist.
It's all terrible.
And I just live down the street from my brother, who looks just like me, except he's totally bald. So we do look like a novelty cruet set when we're walking down the street. And also, he sounds just like me.
Right.
Hello, Ian. Hello, John. It's like talking to... Hello. And then, before the taxi firm, local taxi firm, got a computer, they used to actually take the calls on the phone, obviously. And so sometimes he'd book a taxi at 5:30 in the morning and he'd come to my house because he thought it were him. Hello, taxi from McMillan. Hello. And in fact, my grandson, who's 3, has started doing impressions of me.
Right.
It's very easy to do. Hello, Grandad. Hello, hello. And I like espresso. He's saying that. Have you got an espresso, Grandad? Again, I wish I was making some of this up, but it's all true.
Well, I'm a Yorkshireman as well. I don't sound quite as Yorkshireman as you, because I was untimely ripped from Yorkshire as a 4-year-old.
Part of Yorkshire?
Pardon?
Which part of Yorkshire?
I was born in Pocklington. Pocklington,
fantastic. That's like York with sophistication.
but I don't remember too much about it. But I still have that Yorkshire feeling. There's that kind of...
There's something about... It's a kind of... The word in South Yorkshire is brusson. It's a kind of brussonness. It's a kind of oppositionalness. It's a kind of... We pretend we're Texas. We pretend we're really massive as a county, which we are, but you pretend that you're kind of bigger than you are. They go, what, Britain? It's only that big, but Yorkshire's bigger than Britain. You know, and people kind of make ridiculous claims for Yorkshire about the fact that it invented everything and it did all that. And so, yes, you do have a kind of... You know, and people talk about this professional Yorkshireman thing, but I always think it's better to be a professional Yorkshireman than being an amateur Lancashire man, which must be very strange. Because, as I often say, you can never get a cup of tea out of them in Lancashire. Because you go to their house and they go, do you not want a cup of tea? You go, I don't know, you've not asked me yet. Will you not be having a cup of tea? You've not asked me, do you not want one? Not yet. Have you not had one? No.
This does go out to Lancashire, but you know, fuck them. Fuck them.
I don't think it does because they've sold that radio there.
Oh, they have. Yeah.
There's me thinking it's on the radio. It's a podcast, obviously.
It's all changed. But, you know, you've made that... I mean, is it a choice or has it just happened that you've stayed in the same... Because that's...
Well, it's just happened, really, because... Yeah. For a start, I can't drive, so it's got good rail and road links, rail and bus links,
yeah.
So that's good. My mum and dad live down the street, and as they got older, I had to kind of look after them. And also, I mean, obviously, I could do my job anywhere, but then what I like is that thing I mentioned earlier about getting home, and they all know you.
Yeah.
You know, when you're going to the shop, and they go, we saw you on telly, yapping, you know, as the... And I do like that, the fact that nobody at all is bothered. They gave me the freedom of Barnsley. They rang up, they said, we'd like to offer you the freedom of Barnsley. I said, do I get to march my sheep up Market Hill? And they went, no. I said, do I get a big daft comedy key? And they went, no. I said, can I go into shops and get goods free? They went, no. I said, can I go to Oakwell and watch the Mighty Barnsley for now? They said, no. I said, what do I get? They said, you get a certificate. I said, oh. And so then I must have sounded disappointed because they rang back and said, it's framed. So I've got this framed certificate, but then my brother wanted to go for this thing when I got the Freedom of Barnsley, and my brother went and we got there, and then I was so excited my brother had to get back. I actually left my Freedom of Barnsley at the town hall.
Oh.
So they rang up and said, you've left your casket. I says, I'm not dead, I'm still with you. And your Freedom of Barnsley is actually in a casket like that. And I've not actually, all you get is the casket. You get
right.
So this kind of meta, the Freedom of Barnsley is the Freedom of Barnsley. It's nothing else.
Yeah.
I asked Dickie Bird, who's also got it, I said, do you get free parking? He goes, I've looked into that, Ian, no chance. No chance. But the thing is, it's nice living somewhere that's been on the cusp of change for years, you know, so... When I was little, nothing happened in Barnsley at all. Nothing ever happened. I remember at school we had to write Barnsley in the year 2000, and I put we will eat our dinner in tablet form. We will wear silver space suits, and we will go to the pit on an electric monorail because we thought nothing would change and the pit would always be there. And of course, it's gone. And all these amazing changes have happened in Barnsley over the last 50 odd years. I'm 63, my lifetime. Barnsley has changed so much, and it's interesting that we keep trying to reinvent ourselves, all kinds of things happening, and it's nice to be in that place. You think, you know, for years before they found coal, nothing happened in Barnsley. Occasionally somebody would eat a turnip. You know, that was it. You know, they'd dig a turnip up and eat it, and then I always imagine, like, some toff sat in his house, and a chap runs into house, and he's got coal all over his face, and he goes, look what I found in garden. And toff goes, thank God for that. And then, so now in Darfield, there was a place called Middlewood Hall that was where the bloke lived who owned a lot of the pits. And he had a special wall built that were high enough so he couldn't see him walking past.
Right.
Little blokes in flat caps walking past to make his money for him. You know, he couldn't see it. So that change has happened. So it's nice to be there where change happens, interestingly. Yeah. And it's interesting coming to Sheffield because, of course, Sheffield was always the big city when I was in Barnsley. And the cultural difference between Barnsley and Sheffield, linguistic difference... Yeah. You know, we call them D-dars. Because they go, nah, 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 what are doing, D-D, what are doing? They've got this wide A, nah, nah, then. Are they going to park the car in car park? And my Uncle Jack lived at back of Hillsborough. And every Boxing Day, we'd go to see Uncle Jack. And he always did this trick. He was a joker. So some years he'd put an electric thing and he'd check your hand and it'd buzz. And some years he had like a squirty flower. And one year he bought some fake rubber jam tarts. And he went, nah, then. This is, we're just about to go. And me goes, Narin, would you like a tart with one of us? And me dad, who was a very innocent man, he goes, I'll have a tart, I'll have a tart, Jack. So, me Uncle Jack gave him this rubber jam tart, and me dad bit it, he goes, it's a bit rubbery. And Uncle Jack says, that's because he's a rubberin'. Thereby explaining the gag at the same time. And so then, because in me Uncle Jack's eyes it went well, for the next 20 years, that's all he did. So we'd go every year and he'd go, and me and my dad would go, hope he doesn't get the tarts. I really hope. And my mum would go, look, just pretend you haven't seen him before. And he'd go, Naren, don't I want a tart before you go? He'd go, aye, all right, Jack, I'll have a tart. They're a bit rubbery. Ah, that's because the rubberins. Every year. I do wish I was making this up. You know what I mean? Yeah. When you actually say it, it sounds ridiculous. But it's true.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you some questions about Darfield.
Yes.
Which chemist do you use? The one on Snape Hill Road or the one at the doctor's surgery?
Oh, there was the one on Snape Hill Road. It's funny, the one on the doctor's surgery, you'd think it would be quicker because it's next at doctors.
Yeah.
But the one on Snape Hill Road, but what they said was, you have to order your tablets 2 days in advance, which is like a mythical 2 days. Like, time just slips. So, for example, if I want some tablets now, I should have ordered them in 1972. So I go in and I go, are my tablets ready? They go, no. And they say, well, what's your number? She give me a number. They say, we'll send you a text message. And they don't. At all. They think that by saying the words, we'll send you a text message appears. So last time I went, I said, my tablets are late. They went, well, we send you a text message. I said, no, you haven't. Then when I got home, they sent me one. And I said, look, that's not how it works. You meant to send them before you get... So I used that one. Although I should use the one in the... It used to be a dancing school upstairs, right. That one. That was... So when you get your tablets, you'd hear people doing that upstairs. And it was like the harbinger of doom. You go, have you got me tablets? No, we haven't! I don't know who that was dancing, to be honest with you.
It's good.
Uncle Jack, I think.
Glad I asked that. Have you been to the Morris Dobson Museum?
The Morris Dobson Museum, yeah. The only museum in the world named after a gay cross-dressing ex-marine.
Well, yeah.
Yes. Morris Dobson was a gay cross-dressing ex-marine who, with his partner Fred, ran this shop in Darfield. Okay. And they were fantastic. My mum remembers them walking around Darfield, in her words, looking like Barbara Cartland and Joanna Lumley. And because... because they were ex-military, if anybody said anything to them, they just give them a crack. And so it was a fantastic example, I think, of people accepting people. It was a wonderful thing of acceptance. And Morris and Fred ran this shop, and Morris would go in, and he'd sit there on a high stool in a powder blue suit when he weren't cross-dressing, looking a bit like an old coward, and he had a cigarette in a holder. And he'd say, if you said bugger, I'll give you a spangle. And Morris, Fred was the quieter of the two. Morris was quite flamboyant. And then we thought Morris, because he was the older one, would die first. Fred actually died first. Morris then got religion, and he wanted the church to put the Fred memorial window in the church. Right. And to my great despair, they never did. So when he died, Morris gave his shop to the Barnsley Council, to the Morris Dobson Memorial Heritage Museum. So it's there, yeah, and I volunteer there once a month in the shop. I would invite you to come along. We've got some fantastic pictures of Morris. We've got all kinds of artifacts. We have a cafe. I serve you stuff in a penny.
Okay.
My wife serves stuff in a penny. My grandson's there in a penny. My brother comes. It's like a group of Ian McMillan all in the same room. Yes, I would recommend the Morris Dobson Memorial Heritage Museum. I'd also recommend you went into the churchyard and saw this fantastic memorial stone that says, "Here lies the body of so-and-so who inadvertently pulled this stone upon himself whilst in the service of his master." So this bloke's going, "Oh, I've just flattened my tent." And he goes, "Well, bury him under it. That'll over him."
Also in the churchyard is Ebenezer Elliot.
Ebenezer Elliot, the corn law.
I've looked up the Wikipedia page. I didn't know it was anything to do with the museum.
Yes,
that was just luck.
No, Ebenezer Elliot was the corn law rhymer, and he was a fantastic poet of resistance, and he was buried in Darfield Churchyard, and souvenir hunters used to chip bits off his grave. So John Betjeman came.
Wow.
And it wasn't a television thing. I think he just popped in. And the story is that he said, "We must put railings around Ebenezer Elliot's grave so that people stop chipping things off." Now they have. There's Ebenezer Elliot's grave with things like that. Yeah, I'd recommend it. You can have a full day in Darfield.
Yeah, sounds good.
You can come to the Morris Dobson Museum. You can look at that stone. You can recreate throwing the stone upon yourself with a balsa wood stone. You can go and look at Ebenezer Elliot's grave.
Order your pills when you arrive.
Order your pills, no. Order your pills then, 3 weeks before you set off. Oh, yeah, definitely. You might get a text message. I don't know. You might get one from Morris first.
Okay. Good, that's all I've got about Darfield, but that worked quite well. Yeah, I think you definitely live there. I was just testing to see whether...
There's actually another Darfield. There's a Darfield in New Zealand.
I was there.
And I was hoping to get some kind of twinning going, because I looked up the opening times for Darfield Library, because I'd forgotten, and it said they open Sunday afternoons. I thought, they never do. They haven't opened Sunday afternoons for years. And it turns out there's actually a Darfield in New Zealand, so we might get some kind of town twinning.
Yeah.
Because Barnsley used to be twinned with a town in China called... Well, it was spelled Fuxin, and it was pronounced Fusan, except that the councillors might go, "Oh, we twinned with that the other night, Fuxin." And so they had to change their minds about being twinned with Fusan.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Let's talk a little about you. Good. That was all good stuff. You've got good stuff. You became a poet, basically. Out of all this stuff we talked about earlier, the performance, you became a poet.
Yes.
You worked in a tennis ball factory.
Tennis ball factory in Barnsley, Slazenger's tennis ball factory. Right. What it was, I wanted to be a poet, but it's really hard to make a living as a poet, so... Yeah. Before I worked at Slazenger's, I worked on a building site in Sheffield at Owsley Park at Chapeltown. And I remember getting there on the first day, and I'd been to college, and I got I got this degree called Modern Studies.
Yes.
Which means you didn't work very hard. And from North Staffordshire Polytechnic. And I got there on that first day at the building site, and they were all Sheffielders. They went, Narin, we've heard Dad's got a degree. I says, ah, yeah. They says, that's what we'll call thee, degree. And they used to call me degree. Hey, up, degree, he's here, degree. And I've always read Guardian, and they used to set fire to me Guardian every day. They went, Narin, Darin, have you done that degree? And on the first day, I was walking out building site, and I thought, I've got to get on their side because I'm going to get bullied here. And it was a very muddy building site, and there was a bloke. It stood in mud, and he was sinking up to his knees in mud. He's going, degree, degree, help me, degree, get me out of here, degree. I thought, if I can get him out, I'll be the hero of the day. So I couldn't reach him, so I'm shouting, bloke, sinking in mud. And everybody's driving down, and we're all reaching out. And then suddenly he stood up, because he'd just been kneeling down in mud. And he says, not so clever, had a degree. I said, no, I don't suppose I am. And then I got the sack from there because... because I got a degree, I was put in charge of the stores. And one night I forgot to lock the door. And so these burglars came and emptied the stores. So I got the sack. But then what happened was the firm was called Hassel Holmes. And the next day after the burglary, next day there was an advert in the local paper, the Sheffield Star, that said, doors for sale just like Hassel's. So the police were able to nab the culprits. So then... I left there, I went to work in this tennis ball factory in Barnsley, where we used to make 38,000 dozen tennis balls a week. Wow. I was on a machine called the Buff and Dip machine, where it was like a set of cups like that, and you put these half tennis balls in, and they went round and got buffed and dipped, then you take them out and put them in a tray, and you do that all the time. And I thought, if I can keep... That's interesting, because I might be able to think about writing poems, because That's what I was doing when I was at the building site, but... Yeah. You had to use a little bit of your brain to do it, and that way was kind of, I was becoming atrophied. You know, you couldn't think, and then we put on this thing called, you had to stick the two halves together. And that was when, and that was, it wasn't very good, you know, so that was, and then I applied to this Yorkshire Arts Association, would give you up to £1,000 if you gave your job up. And this is 1981.
Right.
And £1,000 now is a great amount of money, but then a massive amount. So I applied for this £1,000. And they gave me 800 quid, which is a funny amount, because it's not that much less. But psychologically, it feels a lot less. £1,000, £800. But luckily, my wife and my parents are always very supportive. And they went, go on, then give your job up. Become a poet. So then they gave me a job up. And actually, as I walked out, I tried to steal some tennis balls. And so I'm walking out looking like the Michelin Man, all these tennis balls. And I walked out, and the bloke went, good luck in your future career, said the security man. Then he went, give them tennis balls. The thing was, they were high altitude ones, because we used to be the ordinary ones.
For spacemen.
The ordinary ones were 21 pounds of pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you had selling them to somewhere like Tibet,
okay,
they had to have 14 pounds of pressure.
So is there a lot of tennis in Tibet?
Loads of tennis.
Is there? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, sorry to judge the people of Tibet.
But the thing with the high altitude tennis balls is, as he's getting them out, because they're high altitude, they didn't bounce very far.
Right. Well, that's good, because you don't want, if you knock it off a mountain, you don't have to climb
that's
all the
exactly
way down.
What it is. Yeah. And also, of course, there's less air in Tibet, I've been told. Right. They actually bounce the same distance as they would in Barnsley.
Okay.
And it's now shut, and it's been replaced. The tennis ball factory's gone, knocked down, and replaced by an estate called Tuscan Gardens, because in the late 1980s, early 1990s, Will Allsop, the architect, said that Barnsley can be the new Tuscany.
Right.
And people still remember that, and so they met this estate called Tuscan Gardens.
Is there a tennis court on there?
There's no tennis court. There's a couple of tennis balls that are actually buried as part of it. The weirdest job I had there, actually, was on a Sunday morning, if you wanted extra overtime, you'd have to wheel wheelbarrows full of rubber dust through factory. And it was like a fantastic, surreal event, because you'd have these... And they're wobbling, these barrows like that. And they wobble about. And I used to work with a man called Alan, who made his own false teeth out of wood. And he said, it's true. He said, if it's all right for George Washington, it's all right for me. But actually...
I think George Washington made his own, though, did he?
He did. I think somebody made it
for
him. What he actually said was, you mean it's all right for George? Because they were very badly fitting. And also he did that fantastic thing what he used to do. He would go, all right for George Washington, all right for me. And we'd be pushing these rubber dust wheelbarrows, and he'd go, he's not a job, this. He's not a job. I do find The comedy whistling, yes, is great if you're being told off by a superior. I find it deflates the situation. If they go, look, I'm really annoyed with you, you go, I'm sorry. I apologise profoundly and profusely for my demeanour. I think it just, it makes it, it's a nice thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's good. That's good. So, you became a poet.
I did.
What, I mean, you know, take me through your, how does it work being a poet? And is it, you know, how's
well, sometimes
the, how's
you,
the
sit, you sit
day?
There, sometimes you sit there like this. And sometimes you sit there like this. Well, I think, the thing is, I always get up ridiculously early.
Right.
If you follow me on Twitter, you'll know that I get up stupidly early. I've always woken up about 4:30 in the morning. I don't know why, I wake up at 4:30. I think, well, I can't get up at 4:30, so I get up at 5:00, and I think of something, I think of a tweet, and I think that's what being a poet is, thinking of stuff, and I try and think of something. And then I'll go for my early morning stroll, and I walk around Darfield between about 5:30 and about 7:15, and I get back, and I see things, and I tweet them. Best thing I ever saw was and it's always the same walk.
Yeah.
You know, so you're trying to see something different, and that's what being a poet is, trying to see something different, always in the quotidian. So I saw a man in a high-vis jacket walking past a man in a camouflage jacket, and they cancelled each other out. And it was like a do-it-yourself eclipse. It was the most beautiful thing. And so then I'll get back and I'll... And the thing is, because I'm up so early, then my brain is at its best. Then I can think of things, I can write things, I can write things. Sometimes you're lucky enough that people ring you up and say, can you write me a poem about this? Can you do me that? Yeah. Otherwise, you're just thinking of things. Then the trouble is, getting up at that time, by the time Diagnosis Murder comes on in the afternoon, I've gone, you know. So like last night, I was sitting on the... I said to my wife, there's a nice concert on Radio 3. I'm going to listen to this lovely concert. She went, you know, you're going to fall asleep. And I do, and I fall asleep like that. And, you know, people like my son-in-law comes and takes photographs of me asleep. And so it just means... So being a poet is that, I think, for me. It's getting up early and always being available for language, listening to people. You know, you can lean into people... And they say, what are you doing? He says, it's all right, I'm a poet. They go, oh, that's fine, carry on. I've always wanted to go into somebody's house and just sit on the settee and go, hello, what are you doing here? Well, I'm a poet, just carry on. And just people just say amazing things. You hang the tab, as they say in Derbyshire, just listening in. So that's what it involves, really. And also reading lots and lots of poems all the time to try and keep yourself kind of in trim for poems. So it's just that, really. It's a kind of ridiculous but also interesting job. When my three kids were little, I used to write them a poem every day and put it in the lunchboxes and on a little post-it note, which was a nice gesture until my eldest daughter, who was now in her 30s, went to secondary school and went, Dad, never ever put a poem in my lunchbox again. I said, no, I won't. Because it would have been terrible. It's embarrassing enough for having a poet dad. But having a poet dad who puts... I mean, my kids' mates at school didn't think we had a telly. And thought we didn't have any chairs. And thought we all sat round in circles, listening to beat poetry, and not clapping but snapping our fingers like that. Yeah. Which of course we do, but but only till 7:00, then I nod off.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it sounds pretty similar to being a comedian.
Well, it is in a way, because
same sort of job.
It's the same kind of thing, because you're always listening, you're watching, you're using language. I'm so interested in that kind of interface between comedy and poetry. And in the end, so much of it is about just using language and trying to make language just go a different direction to what you're expecting. And it's such a fascinating thing. And you don't have to write it down. You can say it. You know, people who can't... I work a lot with people who, you know, who haven't got great literacy. And you say, look, if you can't write it down, don't matter. Just say it. Just speak it. So, yeah, very, very similar. Very, very close, I think, a lot of them. Some poets aren't very funny, that's a fact. But Philip Larkin, he was terrible. He might have been actually in his house.
Yeah. Well, I had Grayson Perry on recently, as the artist, obviously, and I think that he's got a great sense of humour behind what he's doing as well. Yeah. And I think, again, the art world is somewhere where they're not renowned for their sense of humour. And maybe poetry. I mean, they're fantastic comic poets. I think there is certainly more comedy in poetry, but there's a lot of poets who take themselves very seriously. Do you think that puts people off a little bit, this kind of... There's this idea of the poet that, you know, you don't exemplify, which is
It is true.
Figure.
I go into schools a lot, and if you go into a school, less so these days, but if you go into a school, you say, right, draw me a picture of what the poet's going to look like. They draw this really tall fella, and he's got a corduroy suit on, and he's got patches on his elbows, and he's got a book that says My Poems. and it's often not like that. Some poets are serious. I like serious poets. Some poets are kind of serious, as it were. You know, like being clever.
Yeah.
So they're kind of serious. And they get up. And what always amazes me is they'll have a sheaf of poems to read from, and they never read from the top one. I've noticed that. They always get the thing, and they look at the audience, and they go... And they turn it over like that, and they read the second one. So I'm quite happy with poets being serious, but maybe sometimes I'm not that keen on pomposity, because pomposity is an odd thing that can put people off. I'm convinced that everybody can do it.
Yeah.
You know, my upbringing taught me at school, at junior school, we were taught that everybody can do it, everybody can write, everybody can be artists, everybody can sing. And so I think that everybody can do it. But then the trouble with that is, the quid pro quo is, if everybody can write, then when do we find time to read it? That is a real problem. You know, every day when I'm walking down the street, here, somebody gives me a book. People post me books. I was once in the house, somebody knocked on the door. This fella came to the door. He said, "My dad translates Greek epics into West Yorkshire dialect." I said, "Bless that man." He said, "He's in car." He said, "Will you look at him?" I says, "I will." I says, "Tell him to bring him." He says, "He's in car. He's bent over like a question mark." I said, "Oh." I says, "I'll have a word with him." So I came down thinking, this old fella's in the car, and he banged on roof at car. He went, "Dad, he'll read him. And this hand came out like this. This hand came out, and he passed me this book, and he said, "Here, take him." I says, "Look, with the best will in the world, I'm a busy man. It's going to take me a long time to read." He said, "Take as long as you want." And this was about 1985, and I've still got, I'm not read him yet. But yeah, you do. So I think everybody can do it, but then... you've got to read them. That's the hard thing.
Well, somebody's got to read them. You don't have to read all of them. It's not down to you.
It feels like it is some days. Okay. Honestly, it does. People, and then what you do is people send you a book, and then the next day they'll ring up and say, "Did you like it?" And you'll try and bluff. You go, "Yeah, I think it was great. It was fantastic. The one about page 84. You go, that was my favourite page. And there's only 83 pages. Yeah, I knew that. So, yeah, it is hard. It is difficult. Yeah. But there you go.
But I think your stuff's, is accessible. I mean, you it is about understanding language and... how it works, but it's not off-putting in the way that sometimes poetry can be impenetrable. You know,
I've always liked to be that kind of popular poet, which means you take on interesting jobs. I've been poet in residence at the mighty Barnsley FC for a long time. I was poet in residence for the Humberside Police. That was a strange job. I did an after-dinner speech for a load of chief constables, and the chief constable of Humberside, he said, "You could be our poet." I said, "What would that involve?" He said, "You could go anywhere you want and write poems about it." I said, "Can I bring a film crew?" I met little films. He went, "Yeah." I said, "Can I go out on a Saturday night?" He went, "Yeah." I said, "Can I go out?" And it was interesting because you got to places that poets don't normally get, and you had to make poems up. I went on a dawn raid in Goole. It was amazing. we met these amazing coppers. This copper, he said something I thought I'd never hear anybody say. He said, "Do you know me? I'm a man's man." I said, "No." He said, "We're after two in Goole. We're after a bad lad and a soft lad." I said, "Right." He said, "I don't care about the soft lad, I want the bad lad." I said, "Right." I said, "Can I come and write poems?" He went, "Yes, you can." He said, "But you must come behind the health and safety copper." I said, "I will." So we stood outside this house in Goole, and there was a bloke, there was the hard man, this health and safety copper, and me with a notebook. And they banged the door down, then the health and safety copper put a blanket out, like that, so broken glass wouldn't break at people's feet.
Yeah.
Then he went in, and he goes, "I'm after bad lad." He shouts, "I'm after bad lad." And bad lad ran off. And
that's me.
That was it. And then the soft lad came out, and he went, "Do you want me?" And he was about to... But then afterwards, I said, "That was great." He said, "You must never tell anybody about that." So don't tell anybody. So that was interesting, to be in a place where poets don't normally get.
Yeah.
So that was nice. And that's then the poems that you write about that are not great pieces of art, maybe, but they're kind of, people can enjoy them and people can look at them, and it just leads you to interesting adventures. Because, as you know, part of the fun is when people ring you up, they go, they ask you if you can do something. And I say, always say yes. And it leads to interesting adventures.
Yeah.
And if it don't work, they won't ask you again. So it don't matter. Can you do this? Yes. You know.
So if you're the poet in residence at Barnsley Football Club, it sounds like you're sitting in an office waiting for a footballer to... knock on the door and say, "Can I have a poem about a unicorn?" And they go, "Yeah, sure."
That's more or less the job description, to be honest with you. What happened was, it started many, many years ago, 1997, when we got promoted to our one season so far in the Premier League.
Oh, yes.
And me and my mate, who was a head teacher, we'd been going around lots of schools, and we were sat in the pub, and we had this idea, one of those ideas where the more beer you have, the better the idea goes. And we're going, "What about if they had a poet at the football club?" Let's do that. So we rang them up, we said, "Do you fancy having a poet?" And they went, being Barnsley, they went, well, it cost us out. And I says, well, normally you'd charge a fee, but I said, well, why don't we do it? Because we knew we'd get a lot of publicity. And it meant that it was on the telly a lot and it was on the radio a lot, and if an away team came, you'd write a poem for them. And what it still means is, I used to have to write a poem every week for the Barnsley Chronicle, and they rang up and said, it's got to be 16 lines long, it's got to fit in that space. And sometimes I wrote an 18-line one and they just didn't print the last two lines. And people would go, we didn't understand your poem. Is it that modern poetry? And then what would happen was, but now it still happens, 20 years on. People at the match will go, you'll put that in a poem. But, and then one fella said to me once, you'll not write a poem about this, you'll write a sonnet. And my favourite was, we had a German goalkeeper called Lars Lees in the Premier League. And I wrote this poem that went, Lars Lees, tall as the trees that grow in one well wood. Lars Lees, listen please, we think you're very good. And and it turned out it was pronounced Lars Laser, which didn't make any sense. Ridiculous.
Very good. I'll ask you some emergency questions.
Emergency questions, good.
Yeah. I'll ask, this is a fairly new one, and you can choose from your local museum if you want. But if you could have any one item from any museum or art gallery that you're allowed to take home and keep for yourself in the whole world, but it can be just from your local museum if you want, what one thing would you keep for yourself?
We have a mystery object at the Morris Dobson Museum.
Okay.
That nobody ever guesses what it is. So I'm going to take that home with me.
Okay.
What it is, I'll describe it. It's like a rectangular cuboid, if you like, wooden truncheon with a handle on it.
Okay.
Like a truncheon, but a square truncheon.
Okay.
And on each side of the four sides of the truncheon, there are a number of black spots. It's fantastic.
Right.
And you take it to and you go, what's this then? You hold it up and they go, it's a truncheon. No, it didn't. It's a game. No, it didn't. It turns out what it actually is, I'm going to reveal the secret.
Yeah.
It's a thing from the 1920s for railway men to test their eyesight. So they'd look at that and go, nine spots. And they'd go, eight spots. And they go, seven spots. So I'm going to take that home with me. Then
right.
People come to the house and you have a little bit of fun with them.
Yeah,
you go, hey,
good.
What's this? Mystery object. Eh? And it's not like you're taking something from another culture. You're not taking it away. You're just taking it from the Morris Dobson Museum. So be like that. Hey, guess that. What could that be? You don't know what that is. How many? Nobody's ever guessed it. Nobody's ever guessed it in all the years. They sometimes guess the other one, which is like a wooden tuning fork. That's like that. And people guess that because it's a thing that, again, railway men would put down here when they put brass on the button so it won't get on the shirt. They always guess that one.
Okay.
But they never guess that one with the thing. I'm doing the action now.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's good. Have you ever seen a ghost?
No, I've never seen a ghost, although you have that dream where some tall person is stood at the foot of your bed.
Yeah.
I've had that a few times. I used to have that thing called hypnagogia.
Yeah.
You know, where you wake up and you think you're 94 feet long? It's a weird thing because when you're waking up, the bits of your brain that control perspective wake up later on. And when I was a kid, I used to be scared. And I used to say, Mam, I'm 94 feet long. And she went, well, you'll be able to get plenty of jobs, won't you? You'll be able to get, and you won't need you down the pit. But then, every so often, about once a year, I have a dream. There's a really tall person stood at the foot of my bed, just looking at me. And it's not a ghost, maybe. It's just some kind of memory.
Yeah.
Or it's some kind of thing. But it's weird, and it's just before you wake up, and so you're 94 feet long, and there's a figure stood at the foot of your bed. It's a bit like life in Lancashire, let's face it, but there is that. I'd like to see a ghost, I think, just to see what it would be like.
Yeah. Well, it's not...
Have you seen one?
It's like Robin Hood. No, I have. I've had the same sort of things where and nearly everyone you talk to has seen one. They've just woken up, or they're sort of...
It's part of that thing, you're in this hypnagogic state, and I think it goes back to when you're little... And your mum or dad would be at the foot of your bed just checking you're asleep.
Yeah, yeah.
And so your memory goes back to that, I'm sure. That
Maybe
must be it.
True.
Unless it's a burglar.
I had a thing when I was very tired asleep on a dressing room floor, and then I sort of woke up and there was like a witch on my chest.
Blimey.
Like pushing down. But that's one of the archetypal things that happens.
Yes, yeah.
That you get this kind of... And then a lot of these archetypes come from these visions that you have...
As a child, isn't it?
Well, and this half-waking, half-sleeping thing. And so we've created those rather than the other way around. It's not like, oh, it's that...
So it would
that.
Be really frightening if you saw a real one, wouldn't
it? Yeah. Well, it might have been a real one. It was trying to strangle me.
Oh, well.
I escaped. It was fine.
or did you?
I don't know. This could all be part of a waking nightmare. I don't think so, though. Let's see what else. I like the fact that you tour with. I know this is a different one, but you do a tour show with Tony Husband, the cartoonist, and, yes. and Luke Goss.
Luke Goss, not the Luke Goss.
It'd be great if it was the
so many
Luke
people
Goss.
Think it's the Luke Goss.
I do an endless tour
of Village Halls because yeah. I love doing tours in Village Halls. And he always says Luke Carver Goss because that's his name. But you still get people of a certain age waiting outside with Bros albums. And it's really disappointing when a balding man with a piano accordion gets out of the thing. So, yeah, I do tour with Luke Goss. I tour with Tony Husband. We do a thing called A Cartoon History of Here where we just make it up and we just do cartoons. The thing about Tony Husband is he's a fantastic cartoonist, but he can't stop. So he'll be in a pub and he'll go, "Hello, what's your hobbies?" Somebody to do a cartoon all the time. And he had to do a book of 50 sex cartoons for Anne Summers. And we were... The shop, not the woman. And we were on tour and we were sat in a garden centre in Shropshire because we were between gigs. And he said, "I've just got to do 3 more of these sex cartoons." I said, "Well, I'll go for a walk." And he's sat in the car doing these sex cartoons. And when I came back from the walk, there was a crowd around the car of people, sex staff, people from Shropshire, looking at cartoons.
Like, so, yeah, it's a dogging, isn't it? It's a sort of dog in a car.
It's the equivalent
watching
in
a man drawing.
That's right. So, yeah, and it's nice being on stage with somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, I do like being on stage on my own, but being on stage with somebody else. And with Luke, we'll do songs, and then we make up a song at the end, and we have a little flip chart, and I make up stuff with a flip chart. People give me an idea, we make up songs. It's just nice. And it's just nice going to Village Halls. Village Halls are always different. The worst gig I ever did was in a Village Hall. It was a place called High Ham.
Oh, yes.
In Somerset.
I know it.
And we've been doing a week of Village Halls, and they kept saying, "You think tonight's good? Wait till you get to High Ham. They'll love you in High Ham." And they kept saying, "High Ham." And we got to High Ham, and it was me and my other mate, Martin, who used to be in the band with. And we were just people doing poems and stories. And it said, "Tonight, adult comedians." And I went, "We're not adult comedians. We're just people doing poems and stories." He went, "Oh, you'll be fine." And we did half an hour to complete silence. And this man came to the front and he said, "I'm going to the toilet now. If you say something funny while I'm out, let me know." So I said to my mate, "We may as well go." Yeah. So we went off the stage and the organiser went, "Is that it?" I said, "Well, they don't like it." He said, "Can you come back on stage for the formal vote of thanks and the presentation of the bouquet?" And that was 40 years ago, and I still got cold at the thought of going back on that stage and they give you the bouquet from a 24-hour garage. You know, it's frightening.
But you do lots of radio work.
Yes, I do.
And I haven't heard this series, but you did a series about being a writer where you talked to lots of different writers. Did you pick up anything from that about the writing art, or does it?
Well, I do a show every week on Radio 3
yeah.
called The Verb,
yeah, yeah.
which is about that.
Yeah.
It's about writing. And what you find out with that is that every writer is different. So that every writer will... Some writers will say, "Well, I get up at dinner time and I write for 10 minutes and that's me done." Some writers will say, "I get up very early, I write all day." Some writers will say, "I can't write until somebody asks me to write something." Some writers will say, "First idea, best idea." Some writers will say, "I keep redrafting it until the moment it has to be published." So what that teaches you is that every writer is different, and that's the exciting thing about it. That's why I love doing this Radio 3 show so much, because every week you meet amazing writers who will somehow illuminate different strands of the writing world for you. And it's been repeated on Radio 4 Extra at the moment. Years ago, I did a series about pies called "Who Ate All the Pies?" And it went out on a Sunday afternoon, and I wanted it to be called "Crust Almighty." But they won't let us do that because it went out on a Sunday, but I got to eat pies for 6 weeks on the BBC. It was great. And the best one we had was them terrible pies they have in Scotland called... But are they not got the Scotch pie?
Right.
And I had to go to Dundee, and I had to wear a hidden mic, because in Dundee they don't call it a pie, they call it a peh. Yeah, and if you want an onion one, you go, "I'll have a peh," and an onion yin and ya. And so I had to put this hidden microphone on, and yeah. I had to go into this shop with a hidden microphone and go, "I'll have a peh," and an onion yin and ya. And she went, "You're not from Dundee." I said, "No."
I tell you, it's awful when people do offensive Scottish accents. That's all I will say.
I'm allowed to, because I'm my dad's Scottish.
That's
so
you
I'm
are
allowed.
Allowed. I'm not allowed, so it's no. Okay. It goes out as a podcast, doesn't it, as well, The Verb?
Yeah, podcast, yeah. The Verb podcast, yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well worth listening to. I have heard that one. The other one was a different one, but obviously the same thing. Yes, let me... Oh, no, hold on. I'll be fine in a second. It's right. This is why I have an emergency questions. We'll do that in a sec. We're going to ask you to read a poem as well. You're sort of quite nostalgic, I think, aren't you? Your stuff's quite sentimental.
Well, I am a sentimental man.
Yeah.
So I cry very easily at stuff. But I think, I don't know, I think maybe the older you get, the more you start looking back. I've always tried to look forward as well. But maybe a lot of me writing is about the past, about my childhood, about my family, about people that I knew. But I'm also always trying to look forward, trying to write about the moment. People do accuse me of being sentimental and looking back. Maybe I do a bit too much of that. I'm not sure. But maybe it's just the age that I am. Maybe you do start looking back. I am starting to look like my dad. When I had my hair cut recently, the barber showed me the back of my neck. And I thought, that's the back of my dad's neck. You know, I'm becoming like my dad. You know, I look at myself in the mirror and I think I'm like my dad. And he was such a gentleman. And maybe I am starting to look like him, starting to think like him. So maybe a lot of it is, I don't know, rose-tinted. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but, I mean, those things are always going to be important. The family stuff, the looking back over your life. People, I mean, it's what resonates with people, I suppose.
It is, well, people my age. So you look back at things and you can mention, particularly if you always lived in the same place, you can mention very specific things like Morris Dobson.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you can mention a particular bus number, the 37, as opposed to the 14. And people go, oh, and that's a kind of... I've always been interested in the universal in the local. You can be as local as you want, and that can be universal. The great poet George Mackay Brown never moved far out of the Orkney Islands, but wrote the most amazing universal poetry about the island of Hoy and about the island of Westray and Papa Westray. And you don't have to travel far to actually find universal truths. That's what I reckon. Anyway, I could well be wrong, but that's what I think.
And did it come easy to writing? Because I'm writing something at the moment and I'm way behind and I've struggled and it's painful. And when it's finished, I like it. But when I'm writing it, I kind of hate it. It
depends what you're writing. So writing poems I find relatively easy. I've just been writing a big choral piece for a massive choir in Hertfordshire with Anne Dudley, you know, who's in The Art of Noise, and she wrote the music for Poldark. Right. And she said, I like to write this. So I've written these choral pieces for her, and that was really hard, because you end up writing too much and you try and put the music in the words, and so you have to cut stuff out. And then I've written a couple of prose books, and I found that really hard. Did a book called Neither Note Nor Summit that was like my life, and I found that really hard, just having to cut bits out. They rang up and said, we'd like you to write a book. I said, look, I'm good at short things, I can write columns, I can write poems. They went, no, we'd like you to write a long book. I said, how long? I said, what 30,000 words? And they went, we thought 90,000. And we were all different. And I found that really hard. So some of that kind of writing I find hard. But actually writing poems, because you're thinking about them as you're strolling about on your early morning stroll, half the redrafting is done in your head.
Yeah.
So you think, I find them relatively easy. But I've written an opera recently in Yorkshire dialect, because I thought, can the operatic form, the long note, hold the short vowel? Because we speak in flat vowels, but most operas sung in a long note. And it was very hard. Because what happened was, we got opera singers who were either singing a cod Yorkshire accent, or they just couldn't do it. It was fascinating, utterly fascinating. So they go, I'm coming. And then also the problem of the... That was me doing an opera.
I'm not going to let you get away with that. Have to do more than that.
Well, the other problem within the flat vowel was the T apostrophe.
Right.
Which nobody's ever said. I'm going to... pit. I'm going down. Pit. So you get these opera singers. I'm going. Pit. It was like somebody falling downstairs in armour. You know, it was a frightening sound. But then we got an opera singer from Doncaster actually, who could actually hold that and not do the. It was so fascinating trying to do that. It was an interesting meeting of minds. The other closest we got was somebody from Cardiff, because they had that kind of odd A. Right. Cardiff Arms Park, you know, so they were able to do that thing. But it was interesting, because I always think that, as the great Leeds poet Tony Allison said, people who talk like me are the ones they give the comedy parts to. You know, so to try and show that you can write a high art like an opera in this kind of verse. Because a lot of people don't like my voice, I know that. Some people think I put it on. People think, oh, I talk like Prince Charles. And in fact, the opposite is the case. At home, Prince Charles talks like me. Which would be great, wouldn't it? That would be so great. That would be great. But people say, oh, he puts it on. He doesn't talk like that in real life, then, us. And, you know, I actually do in the house, talk like this. I haven't got a microphone in the house, obviously, but apart from that, it's just the same.
And I was saying at the beginning, you know, the end of the decade, do you think this... Does the decade meaning this 10 years since 2010? Do you feel like a lot's changed since you were... You'd have been about my age 10 years ago.
Well, I'm 63 now, so I was 53 then.
And yes, I'm 52.
I mean, part of it is that thing where people say, well, of course, it's not the new decade till 2011. So all that kind of rap.
Yeah.
But I remember I was in the same house of the decade, and you felt kind of... 2009, you felt sort of hopeful, didn't you? You thought, well, things can only get better. Things are going to be great. Even though we've had this terrible crash, you think, well, we'll be fine. We'll be all right. They'll be opening new libraries. There'll be plenty of sure start centres carrying on. We'll keep going. The North won't get neglected. Somehow things will happen. You know, it'll be great. Tories will never get in again, ever, ever, ever. And then you kind of get here and you think, oh, that was wrong. That was totally wrong. That was it. You know, and you think, and so, yeah, you just hope for better things for the next decade, really, you do, because... Yeah. I still feel full of energy and vim, but you think in 10 years, you know, and I'm 73, will I still feel as full of energy and vim if things have gone downhill in the same way they have in the last 10 years? That would be a bit scary, won't it, I reckon? I'll still have a full head of hair, I'm hoping, because my brother's bald, my dad was bald, and my son's bald, but I've got my mum's hair. So hopefully I'll still have a full head of hair when I'm 73. So I'll look a bit like this, except I'll be more wrinkled, but I'll still have a full head of hair. I'll look a bit like Melvin Bragg. That'll be great. But no, looking ahead 10 years ago, I never foresaw what would be happening now. But then again, you never would you? You wouldn't foresee
I mean, it has. When you think of this decade in those terms, it's been... It's been quite a big shift.
It's been a
heck I mean, of even shift. From 2012, I had Frank Cottrell Boyce on talking about the Olympics, which hasn't gone out yet, won't have gone out when this goes out. But so much has changed since, you know, the feeling in the UK that we had when the Olympics was here. It's sort of within 4 years.
And that's the other reason that you stay where you are. I stay where I am, because you think, well, eventually the North, it's got to rise again, hasn't it? Something's got to happen in the North. Something's got to shift. So that I think... I always talk about maybe the Queen should move to Barnsley. You know, that would start it. And maybe on the coins, say, Fidef, Idimp, Ore, Ada, Gwynon. You know, actually say that on the coins so that it would feel... Because you always think that all the economic power has always been sucked down into the South. And if somehow we could just suck a bit of it back up, you know, if they have HS2, if it actually starts in Barnsley, you know, then people would want to come. That would be fantastic, I think, in my humble opinion. You know, but that probably won't happen, Richard, to be honest with you.
I think that some of that probably won't happen.
No, some of that won't
never. Well, so much has happened in the last 10 years, you never know what might happen.
You never know.
It's been lovely to talk to you. Do you want to read us some poetry?
Can I read just one poem? Is that all right?
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
I've got in this bag called The North.
Okay.
I'm going to put the microphone down.
Okay. That's all right. I'll cover for you. He's getting the book out of the bag. He's picked it up.
So I'll read a poem.
He's back.
This is my new... I've written a new pamphlet.
Good.
Of poems. I love pamphlets because they're not like books. They're just little pamphlets. They're great. I love pamphlets. And because they're not a book, they're just little tiny things that you can hold in your hand. And so this is a kind of... It's a fairly serious poem, I suppose. And I love that word, oh, without an H. It's a great poetry thing, oh.
Yeah.
With an H, it's kind of, oh. But without an H, it's kind of declamatory. Oh! And I read that terrible thing, December 2018, there was a bit in the paper where it said a food bank opens in a primary school in Norfolk. You think, God, I wouldn't have seen that coming in 2010.
No.
Or 2000, I mean. So it is called the food bank in the primary school. And it's about that thing, well, anyway, it's just about that. That horror. And each line starts with, oh. Oh! Tins of beans beside those little infant chairs. Oh, deputy head bringing pasta in an Aldi bag. Oh, reading corner where soup is stored because everybody donates soup. Oh, children with faces that belong to their grandparents. Oh, unforgiving gulls circling the playground. Oh, single tin of raspberries like a cartoon sunset. Oh, stray hairs in the nose of the uncle sent with carriers. Oh, bright paintings by year two children in vivid colours. Oh, girl in her brother's shoes. Oh, sums you are needed needed here. You are needed here. Or children who thought this was a role-playing area. Or teachers who wished this was a role-playing area. Or past sell-by date the NQT saw and didn't say. Or rain beginning to fall just before home time. Or school caretaker sweeping up spilt sugar. Or dinner lady weeping into the parts of her pinny she can reach. Or parents forming a patient queue with the odd tired jostle. Or spider on the ceiling observing this facet of civilization. Or year six girl helping to carry heavy boxes, heavy things. Or skipping reception children. Or Tory MP standing for a photo opportunity with his donation. Or Tory MP standing for a photo opportunity with his donation. Or Tory MP standing for a photo opportunity with his donation.
Brilliant. Tribute. It sounds like there's a lot coming in 2020 for you. Anyway, lots of things coming up.
Yes, I'll finish my new choral piece.
Yeah.
I'm writing a play. I'm hoping to carry on with the male modelling. Just a bit of catalogue work. You know, pointing in a tank top. It's the future.
It's been absolutely fantastic to meet you, ladies and gentlemen. Give a massive round of applause, Ian McMillan.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Come again next week. We've got another one next week. Come and see us then. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Tang, and my guest, Ian McMillan. Thank you to Pest for coming out on tour. I haven't even paid them for doing that and playing this lovely music. Thank you to everyone at Sheffield City Hall, to everyone at Acast, everyone at Go Faster Stripe. My producer for this show is James Hingley. My series producer I'm indebted to is Ben Walker. This is a Fathers Go Faster Stripe.com and Sky Potato production. Go to rahalastapa.co.uk to find out more. Why not become a badger? Pay £3 a month, get loads of extras, and help us make even more podcasts. If you like these, why not? £3 a month. I'm putting out 8 a month at the moment. Think how little that is. I mean, it's not as good as being free, which it is as well. But, you know, what can I say? I haven't really thought that through, have I? That's what I can say.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.